Welcome back, everyone.
Let's remind ourselves of where we're at. We're going through the ceremony, the description of the ceremony, and we took a little sidetrack to talk about this issue of women learning Torah, the hook being that the anonymous opinion here holds im yesh la zchut haita tolala, that if she has merit of some kind, like there are good deeds, or the best example of merit you can find is Torah learning, then the punishment of the sota is suspended for her, which we weren't sure whether it totally meant totally suspended, as in like she will not have the death of a sota at all, or whether like this exact death of the sota will happen to her. It will just happen later than now, like in a few years' time or something. And the same ambiguity with the next line about yesh zchut tola shana achat, yesh zchut tola shtei shanim, etc. Like, we weren't sure whether that meant that the maximum was 3 years, or that means that it could suspend forever. So we had a bunch of ambiguities there, and that led us to talk about learning Torah. Ben Azai and Rabbi Elazar had different psychological readings of the wife going through the sota ceremony. Ben Azai thought that she would, if she survived the ordeal, she would think that perhaps she only survived it because she had learned Torah in the past, and therefore that will be less likely to make her do more adultery in the future. Whereas Rabbi Elazar is worried that women are going to commit as much adultery as they want and also learn Torah and rely on their Torah learning to protect them from the ceremony. And in that context, we had a Rabbi Yeshua who said two things which were basically unrelated to what's going on. Seems like the main hook is the similar word, tiflut and tiflut. And then we have frishut and frusha. That seems to be the main hook for these two statements, Rabbi Yeshua. They really have anything to do with the sota at all. The first statement, and now this is where I wanted to pick up. First statement was about wives prefer poorer husbands who are around than richer husbands who are not around. That's the Rotza, Isha, the Kav, the Tiflut. Women prefer one Kav, a smaller amount, and frivolity, than nine Kavs and abstinence. That's a claim, which you can agree or disagree with, but that's what Rabbi Yeshua thought. Goya Omer, and then he has a second statement, Chasid Shoteh, Rasha Arum, the Isha Frusha, Umakot Prushin, Haru Elu Machale Olam. These are the people who destroy the world. There's a bunch of ways you can understand all of these particular labels. So Chasid Shoteh, a pious fool or a pious madman. The classic example of that is in the Talmud, a guy who refuses to save a drowning woman because he won't look at her. In other words, he's incredibly pious by not looking at a woman, but does it in stupid ways, which is like, obviously, you have to save someone's life. You have to do whatever you can. Rasha Arum, a cunning, wicked person. The Talmud's example of that is someone who's stricter about the law with others than with themselves, but it clearly is broader than that. Isha Frusha, a abstinent woman or a separatist woman. Not at all clear what that means exactly. The root here is lifrosh, to separate, parush, to be separated. So I don't know what that means. Isha frusha could mean abstinent, as in separated from sex, or it could be separatist in some other ways, like in terms of practice. Umakot prushin, and this last one is a discussion of a large discussion. So it uses the same roots, prusha, prushin. But Prushin also means Pharisees, as in the particular Jews from the first century who called themselves Pharisees. That would also be Prushin. Now, the exact etymology of the word Prushin is not at all obvious. A lot of people have tried to derive the word Pharisees from the Hebrew root parush, to be separate, that they were defined by their separatist practice in purity or other things. It's not really obvious in any way that that is in fact the root of the word Pharisees. It's not clear in what way they were actually separatists from others, especially compared to other first century Jews, like the Jews at Qumran, who lived in their own community in the middle of the desert. They seem like real separatists Pharisees lived in the society with everybody else, not clear at all what kind of separatism they had. Regardless, it seems like this is not just separatists broadly, but this is about Pharisees specifically. The Mishnah rarely talks about Pharisees or Sadducees. I have many rants about people making connections between what the rabbis say and the Pharisees and Sadducees, which and I'll give you a shortened form, which is that most people assume that the early rabbis were all Pharisees and they were proto, the rabbis are sort of the continuation of the Pharisaic tradition. There's basically no evidence for that whatsoever. The only evidence you have, there's two pieces of evidence you have. The first one is, the only evidence you have from the Mishnah, let's put it that way. The only evidence from the Tanaim you have from the Mishnah is about the Pharisees, is rabbis and Pharisees, is number one, there's a few people in the list, about approximately three people in the list of maybe four, of in Pirkei Avot, of the early rabbis, some of whom are mentioned as specifically being Pharisees by Josephus. That includes, what's his name, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. He was a Pharisee, according to Josephus. Rabban Gamliel, the first one, he was also a Pharisee, according to the New Testament. And possibly Shemaiah and Avtalion were Pharisees. Josephus has a story about two Pharisees called Polion and Semaeus, which could be Avtalion and Shemaiah. So there is evidence that some of them were Pharisees, not at all evidence that they were all Pharisees. The other piece of evidence you have is that one thing that is known about the Pharisees is they have extra Torah traditions. They have oral traditions of the ancestors. That's one of the things that Josephus says about them. So therefore the Mishnah, that's a whole set of extra traditions. That's a, you know, traditions of the ancestors, a passed down oral Torah. But the truth of the matter is that every Jew had passed down ancestral traditions. It's not possible to live by the Torah alone. Like the Sadducees, of course, also had all sorts of extra Torah traditions. Otherwise, like, doesn't make any sense. It's impossible to do it otherwise. So it's not at all clear what it means to say that the Pharisees had this tradition of the ancestors and how that relates to the oral law at all. Not at all clear. Also in the Mishnah, in Yadayim, there's a text where Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai clearly seems to oppose the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which would imply that he is neither a Pharisee nor a Sadducee. Which seems very likely. And in fact, the Mishnah portrays itself as the continuation of the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin included Jews that were Pharisees, Sadducees, maybe Essenes, maybe nothing. A lot of Jews were just normal Jews, but did not have a particular affiliation with a particular club, like the Pharisees or Sadducees or Essenes. So yeah, they portray themselves as the continuation of the Sanhedrin, not the continuation of the Pharisees. The continuation of the Pharisees picks up in a response to Christianity. So Christians use the word Pharisee to mean, based on the New Testament, to mean hypocrites, because the Pharisees that Jesus criticizes in the New Testament are criticized for their hypocrisy, for saying how pious they are, but not acting in the right way, not acting morally. The Christians use that, early Christians use that attack, line of attack against the Jews, the contemporary Jews in the fourth, fifth century kind of thing. That's where it seems to the first clear instance of Jews claiming to be, rabbinic Jews claiming to be descended from the Pharisees, comes from that period or a little later, which sounds like it's more like a response to Christianity that, the Christians basically were like, you Jews, you're all Pharisees, you're all hypocrites. And the Jews were like, yeah, you're right, we're Pharisees. Like, yeah, we're going to own the Pharisee label. We have this ancient tradition, the oral Torah, and that sort of picks up from there. So the Mishnah here has a clear, possibly clear, assuming the word Prushin here means Pharisees, which, again, don't know for sure, but let's assume it does. If it does mean that, then what they have here is a criticism of Pharisees, Makot Prushin, the blows of the Pharisees, which in line with the New Testament criticism of them could mean something like they flagellate themselves to show how pious they are. They like sort of strike themselves they show their piety, but actually hypocrites. They're not. They don't act piously. They don't act in the good moral way. If so, then this would, if that's what this means, which is how most people understand it, that would be totally in keeping with this environment. The only thing that we know about Pharisees is that they're hypocrites, basically, according to Jesus. And as you say, Lucy, it's very polemical. Yeah, Jesus definitely belonged to a sect that was not the Pharisees. Yeah, or no sects at all. It's not clear exactly what it means to say that there are sects per se. A key thing is, like, I think a lot of people have this misconception about first century Judaism, that the sects were like denominations, you know, whichever, you had to go to a Pharisee shul or a Sadducee shul or an Essene shul, and like, that's totally not true. Probably, you know, the people who were involved in a sect was like 1% of the population. You know, we're talking about rich men who had the time to hang out and learn and join social clubs. It's a very small portion of the population. Most of the population didn't care at all. They were just Jews, didn't care about Pharisees or Sadducees. It was irrelevant to them. The reason, and also the other thing is, our sources are so, our sources about them from the first century are so scattered and opaque that, like, anyone who says we know something for certain about the Pharisees or certain about the Sadducees, even more so, or even the Essenes, they are lying. They haven't read the evidence correctly. There's very little we can say about any of them. Very hard to know what they believed, how they practiced. You just get such random scattered information about it. Where did 99% of Jews get religious guidance? So a guy called E.P. Sanders wrote a book where he goes through to find what's called common Judaism, which he tries to basically like work out, given that our sources come from the elite, how can you reconstruct what Judaism is like for the common people? So he tries to do that. And a few other people have done similar things. Basically, they loved the temple. Jews loved the temple. It was very important to them. They brought sacrifice to the temple. They got guidance from priests. They got guidance from scribes, all sorts of people who knew things. Some of those priests and scribes could have been Pharisees or Sadducees or Essenes, or they might not have been. Could have been just random Jews. The core element of the religion in first century was certainly the temple. And there's starting to be like social clubs and synagogues starting to pick up some ritual aspects. But yeah, they got religious guidance mostly from priests, for sure. Or scribes and other scholars. There's like, a lot of overlap between all of those classes, between scribes, priests, and scholars in general. There's like a lot of overlap. It's not just people who engage in Perush as an explanation. Yeah, so Maxine, it could be that Perushim comes from the sense of Lifrosh as in to explain, that they explain the tradition. Could be, but we just don't know enough, especially because it's like a transliteration from the Greek. Sadducees is slightly easier, perhaps, because it's Tzedukim, which comes from the name of Tzadok, who's a high priest, but also not clear that that's where it comes from, especially because the word Essene, there's no sense at all where the word Essene comes from in Hebrew. It doesn't seem to be a Hebrew word, doesn't seem to be a Greek word. The origin of the word Essene is incredibly obscure. Makot Perushim. This seems to be a criticism of the Pharisees that seems to be similar to the kind of New Testament criticism of the Pharisees, that they sort of act out their piety for performance, but don't actually act it out in their lives. They're not moral people. They just pretend to be. Or it could mean anything else. Makot Perushim is a very obscure phrase, not at all clear what it means. No one knows where the Essene comes from, 100%. No one knows who the Essenes were. There's a classic theory of connecting the community of Qumran to the Essenes. Not a lot of evidence for it at all. Some counter-evidence. Josephus thinks the Essenes live in normal towns, certainly don't live in the desert by themselves. The main evidence you have is Pliny the Elder, who's a Roman historian who lived in Rome and, by the way, never went to Eretz Israel. And he says that there's a group of Essenes living on the Dead Sea. But he's never been to Eretz Israel. He doesn't know anything about it. Why would we trust what he says? So no one knows where the Essenes come from. No one knows exactly what they did. Essenes is we have both the most and the least information about them. Rabbinic sources never refer to the Essenes, as far as we can tell, unless they use another word for them. So all we have is Philo and Josephus. Philo and Josephus both loved the Essenes. They loved them. So they talk about them a lot, but what they give is not necessarily conducive to actual historical reconstruction. We know a lot about Qumran in the sense that they wrote about it themselves, but that gives a whole different kind of spin on how to interpret the evidence because they're talking about themselves. So it's hard to know what they're talking about there. Bunyan's book on the Mark's Gospel presents Jesus as a traditionalist, opposing the innovations of the Pharisees. Yeah, it could be. I mean, he also is a huge rebel as well in other ways. Like, he allows people to eat on Shabbos, which is like a crazy radical position, like to pick corn off the grain. It's like a pretty radical position in first century. So I think he's probably a traditionalist in some ways and probably a innovator in other ways. So there's just no way to know, Philip and Judith. There's just no way to know. The evidence is just not enough to say that the Essenes are lived in Qumran, or the Qumran sects were Essenes. There's literally just not enough evidence to prove one way or the other. One of the ways that they did the assignment is, firstly, Pliny. You can't necessarily trust what Pliny says. He doesn't know anything about Israel. He's never been there. Another thing that they do is the fact that the Essenes had communal property, and so did Qumran. That may be true, but Qumran also is a sect that lived in the middle of the desert, away from all of society. So obviously they had communal property. It was the only way that they could deal with the situation, right? They had to pool their resources in order to survive. So not clear. Josephus and Philo both talk about the Essenes as if they're in participating in the normal society in towns, in normal Judea. So again, not clear at all. And also, by the way, that the Qumran sect loved Tzadok, the priest Tzadok, so which suggests that maybe they're Sadducees. Yaakov Sussman found that some legal opinions, which are given to the Sadducees in the Mishnah, are espoused in Qumran. So that would also suggest maybe they're Sadducees, or maybe they're nothing. Maybe they're none of those, and just a crazy group of nutters in the desert, which they definitely were. There just isn't enough evidence to suggest one way or another. And I'm telling you to be cautious when you see people make grand claims about this. There is not enough evidence at all. And the key thing about this Makot Prushin is there's no clear evidence that the rabbis of the Mishnah thought of themselves as Pharisees, or the continuation of the Pharisees. There's no clear evidence of that at all. And that's why you can find this kind of criticism of the Pharisees right here, because they don't think of themselves as Pharisees. That's a later innovation. First sort of starts to pick up steam in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. That was a long rant about a thing which I see a lot of disinformation out there. So there you go. Also, by the way, Philip, do you reject the identification of some Dead Sea Scrolls as Essene documents? It could be that some of those scrolls are Essene documents. That may also be true, and that doesn't necessarily prove that they are Essenes or not. Another example is, like, you know, the Qumran loved the Book of Jubilees, which is in the Apocrypha. They love the Book of Jubilees. And not at all clear whether they practice according to the Book of Jubilees. For example, the Book of Jubilees has a solar calendar, a totally solar calendar, as opposed to our calendar, which is lunar solar combined. It's not clear that Qumran had a solar calendar. So we just don't know. After that aside and big rant about the first century Jews, we're now going to come back to the question of what the first Tanna said over here, the majority opinion, which is just, your merit can suspend the punishment. That was just the basis that we set up here. Under that assumption, we talked about whether Torah learning was a good idea in order to provide sfut for your daughters. Now we're going to actually come back to that assumption, and we're going to see that it's not what everyone agrees. Rabbi Shimon at least thinks that assumption is not true. And Rabbi possibly modifies it in a certain way. So Rabbi Shimon Omer, Ein zchut tola b'mayim hamarim. It's not true that your merit can suspend the punishment of the bitter waters. And now he's going to give like a really interesting argument, again, going into the psychology of why it can't be true. He's not making a claim about reality to a certain extent. He's not making a claim that God will not, God will or will not withhold the punishment because of merit of Torah learning. He's making a sort of psychological argument. Imata omer hazchut tola b'mayim hamarim. If you were to say that actually, as you said in the previous Mishnah, that merit can suspend the punishment of the bitter waters, madhe'ata et hamayim b'fnei kol hanashim hashotot. You would discredit, you would make the waters useless, basically. You would fade it before all the drinking women. Right? It would no longer be effective. It would not be an effective punishment. And it would spread bad rumors about the innocent women who drank the waters. She'omrim, because people will say, they actually did commit adultery, but they just learned Torah, or they had other, you know, good deeds, and that's the only reason that the punishment was suspended. So Rabbi Shimon is worried that, like, people will, no one will be able to trust the ceremony, that people will wonder about the ceremony and always have doubts. The whole point of the ceremony is to clarify the doubt about whether she actually committed adultery or not. If you think that zechut can suspend the punishment, you haven't actually dealt with the doubt. The doubt will always be there. You'll never know if the waters did nothing because of their merit, which is unrelated to their adultery, or because they're actually innocent. I just want to say that that may in fact be the exact point of saying that merit can suspend the punishment. That might be the whole point of saying that, which is to say, but yeah, like the ceremony doesn't work. and therefore I need an out to show, to explain why sometimes it doesn't work, even when it seems like the person is guilty. I need an out to explain that. That seems to be the first opinion. Rabbi Shimon is saying, you're discrediting the whole process by saying that. And what I'm saying is, yeah, that may exactly be the point that the first Tana was trying to say, which is that, yeah, this whole process is discredited. but Rabbi Shimon can't stomach that. He can't think that the ceremony would be discredited in that way. It must be that the ceremony is effective and clarifies the doubt involved, and therefore it can't be that merit can suspend the punishment, because then we just create all this doubt. This would have a major effect on the husbands who most need to be convinced. Yes, right, exactly. Rabbi Shimon is like trying to think about as well, also the husband thinking, going out of this, be like, well, I don't know what happened. Maybe she is just a good person. That would also be a problem. False negative, exactly. But this is just a great, I love these this argument. It's just gets to the heart of what the ceremony is about. On the one hand, they're like, yeah, the ceremony doesn't really work, it's all about your merit anyway. And Rabbi Shimon is turning around saying, it can't be that the ceremony doesn't work. What's the point of the ceremony if it doesn't work? Very interesting debate. There's a bunch of ways to understand Rabbi, but one way to understand him is he's doing some kind of compromise position. Right, well, there's no point to the ceremony according to the first opinion, which might be true. And remember, like, one of the key focuses of the Mishnah throughout has been to avoid this ceremony ever being carried out. So Rabbi possibly does some kind of compromise. Rabbi Omer, Hazchut tola v'mayim marim. No, Rabbi Shimon, don't be ridiculous. Of course, merit does suspend the punishment of the bitter waters. But actually, it does do something to her. It means that she will no longer give birth and she'll no longer improve. Mishpachat literally means to improve, like to profit. So she'll no longer like thrive. She'll no longer get better. The point being that the promise in the verses is that if she is innocent, she will then have a child. And remember that my argument was that the actual shot of the verses is that she's already pregnant, and the poison causes a miscarriage if she's guilty, but otherwise she should have a healthy child. So Rabbi is trying to do like a middle position where, like, yeah, you're right, merit does suspend the punishment, but not totally. She will not get the promised child that the Torah promises if she's innocent, because she's not innocent, right? She will not be able to have children after that. Ella mitnavna v'holechet. Rather, she sort of gradually becomes disfigured. In other words, like the punishment of the description of the eyes popping out and the veins coming through, like that will happen to her slowly, not instantly. L'sof himeta v'otamita. And in the end, she'll die of the death of the sota. She'll die through the death that the poison would have caused. So in other words, we've talked about whether the previous opinion thought that she would eventually die of the sota's death or not. It sounds like, based on Rabbi's clarification, that maybe they thought no, that actually, like, she would never die of the sota's death. She would just die of other other causes, and you would never know if she had a Sotah's death or not. And then Rabi is coming along and saying, no, it does. It, the doubt isn't really there, because eventually she'll still die, and you'll know that she, it was because of the Sotah, because she'll die the same death as the Sotah. So not only will she not have the reward of being innocent, she'll have the punishment for being guilty, but it'll just be suspended. It'll just be waited until her merit sort of runs out from protecting her. And it will sort of happen gradually instead of happening instantly. So that's how Rabi tries to so in that reading, Rabi sort of tries to make a mediating position between the anonymous opinion from the last Mishnah and Rabbi Shimon here. He takes Rabbi Shimon's criticism seriously and is worried that people will doubt the efficacy of the ceremony. And so therefore he comes up with a mechanism by which the ceremony will be effective and truthful in the end, but it just takes longer. It might be that Rabbi, however, is actually just clarifying the first opinion. So it could be that Rabbi is just saying, when the first opinion said that the punishment is suspended for a certain number of years, then what that means is punishment suspended doesn't mean she won't die of a Sotah's death. It means she will eventually die of a Sotah's death. The punishment is suspended. It's sort of elongated. It's stretched out over a number of years instead of instantaneously. So in that way, he would be doubling down on the previous opinion and explaining what the previous opinion was about, instead of trying to provide a compromise position between the previous opinion and Rabbi Shimon. So you have both options available of how to read Rabbi. He's either coming up with his own compromise between the earlier opinion and Rabbi Shimon, or he is doubling down on the earlier opinion and explaining the earlier opinion in a particular way. If she keeps learning Torah, she will never die. Well, so that's a theme in the Talmud as well, which is that you can't die while you're learning Torah. There's a whole cycle of stories in Kiddushin where the angel of death or Satan has to sort of distract the rabbi from learning in order to be able to take them up to in order to for them to die. that is a thing that they kind of believed, though not necessarily the Mishnah, but yeah. But also it depends on how you read this. Which is that it's possible that there's a maximum, right? Because over here it was Yeskut to Lashana Achat. Maybe there's some merit which will give you 1 year, some merit will give you 2 years, some merit will give you 3 years. So that could be a maximum of 3 years, or maybe 6 years if you add it all up together. Like certain merit gives you one, combine it with another one, two, another one, three. But so you could read this as saying it's a maximum. Or you could read that as like, yeah, you keep learning Torah, you'll never die. Great. Some great Mishnah today. I will see you tomorrow. Yeah, we don't have time to go to the next thing. So next thing is now starting to go back to the ceremony and some more sort of sacrifice stuff, like what happens when the sacrifice gets messed up or gets impure halfway through. We're going to go into those kind of questions.